actually really delighted to be here. I love being able to come speak at a place, A, that's my own church, which is always exciting, and B, that I don't have to get on an airplane. It's very exciting. I'm not actually feeling 100% today, so do you guys mind if I just kind of, if we just have a little casual conversation tonight? I'm going to share some of the stuff that I've learned and then do a Q&A, a question and answer time at the end, and we'll have some time where you guys can talk. But so I can preserve my energy for that whole time. Hope you don't mind if I sit down every now and then. I told my daughter today when she got home from school, my husband said, you know, Mom isn't feeling 100%. And she said, were you on that plane with the lady that with Ebola? And I'm like, first of all, that news just came out today and you're 14. How do you know that? And secondly, no, I have not been on a plane in the last week. So no. But don't you like your kids, what they come out with every now and then? It's crazy. So let me introduce myself a little bit. For some of you have heard me speak at the Marriage Hour or at Harvesters. How many of you have heard some of what I shared of my research in the last year or so, either at Harvesters or the Marriage Hour? How many of you have heard some of it? Okay, so bear with me. You're going to hear probably at least a couple of things that overlap. I hope that's okay with you guys. I'm married to a wonderful man named Jeff, who we just celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary about 3 weeks ago, and which is very exciting. And I have a ministry here that we've had for the last 10 years. We're doing social research and unexpected right-hand turn. I used to be an analyst on Wall Street, analyzing large Japanese banks, and now I'm analyzing men, and who knew it was the same skill set? So it's been really interesting to see how God has used that background to really be able to dig out things that really matter to us in our lives and relationships rather than just matter to Wall Street firms. And I love it. And I have Caroline, where are you? Caroline works for me. Caroline Naziel is here. And if you have any questions, by the way, that we don't get to and you want to write them down, and, you know, we can always email you back an answer if you get a question to me or to Caroline. So I also have, as a mom, since we're here, a lot of us as wives, a lot of us as moms, and I know we have some single moms as well. As a mom, I have a 14-year-old daughter who just started ninth grade. I'm really not sure how that happened. And a 11-year-old son who's in sixth grade. So that's where I am. And two cats who think they're dogs. So that's our household. Let me tell you a starting point of what we're going to talk about for about 40 minutes-ish. And then, like I said, we're going to try to have about 15 minutes of questions and answers. Is that okay with you, by the way, to have some Q&A time? Okay, good. So bottom line, because I've spent the last 10 years, really it's been longer than that now because the research started before that, so probably about the last 12 years, digging out the things that really matter in our lives and relationships that make a big difference to us, it's often stuff I've found that we don't know that matters. And I've realized that one common denominator underneath the surface of so many things that kind of go on in our life that we wish were a little bit different, and sometimes you have conflicts with a spouse, or for those of you who are single parents, you know, with a boyfriend or potential in a dating relationship, we have these romantic relationship confusions and heartaches sometimes, and sometimes with our kids, and we're like, who are you and what have you done with my child, right? And there's these confusion, and there's sometimes slammed doors, and just this feeling like, angst sometimes. Not always, but certainly sometimes. And one of the things that has been a common denominator underneath all of that that really rises to the surface out of all these different research studies that I've done over the years is that so much of that heartache and that confusion doesn't have to be there. And that so often it's because we just don't know. We really don't. Our eyes aren't opened to a few things that really make a pretty big difference. And often it's not big, huge, big ticket issues that make the big difference. Often it's actually pretty small, simple ones. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're always easy to implement, but it's not usually rocket science. And so that's really what I want to share tonight is what are, and I identified kind of, if I had to skate over the surface of saying basically five things in our time, since we don't have that much time, what are the five top things from my research that if I said, okay, if you only know this, you know, if I only have this few minutes, what is it that you have to know that will make the biggest difference if you don't know it already? And some of you will know some of these things already. But what is it that you really have to know? So I've identified what to me are the top five things. And they're very subjective, by the way. And so I'm sure some other stuff is going to come out in the question and answer time, which is fantastic. So let me just dive in to the sort of the first and the most kind of standard setting thing. The first principle is to recognize that we have to recognize that you don't know what you don't know. I know it sounds kind of funny, but to recognize that we are really actually quite blind to seeing certain things if we're not kind of keyed to notice them. And we have to pray and ask God to help us open our eyes, to open our eyes to the things that we're just not seeing that will make a really big difference for us. Because I truly believe when Jesus says things like, you know, my yoke is easy and my burden is light, He means that. It doesn't feel like that sometimes, but He says that. He says all this stuff about living an abundant life. So that kind of stress and that tension and all of that, yeah, some of that will come from living in a fallen world and we are fallen, imperfect people. Absolutely. Some of that, you can do everything right and still have things go wrong. But I am firmly convinced, having seen the reaction over the years in our ministry, I'm firmly convinced that there is a huge amount of that stress in our relationships that never has to happen. So opening our eyes is the first thing. Let me tell you a story. And at the end of this, I'm going to actually ask if we can stop and pray for a second, because this to me is a really important touchstone story in my life. And it's very personal. I'm just going to kind of open myself up because you guys are my family. You guys are my church. And be real honest about something. So when I came to know the Lord for the first time for myself, I was almost 22 years old, graduating from college. And it was just a few months before graduation, I really met Jesus for myself. And I had grown up in a church, but I didn't get it. And the church was a wonderful, loving place, wonderful, loving people, but I'm not sure that I ever heard the gospel actually presented. I didn't understand the Jesus thing. That's what I called it. I didn't understand the Jesus thing at all. And there was no personal relationship. I thought it was about being good. So I finally come to the realization that, wow, no, you can never be good enough. And it's about this relationship and turning your life over to Him and letting Him run your life. This is a whole new concept for me. And the problem was that even though that was wonderful and life transforming, and I got myself into a good Bible teaching church, I was almost 22 years old. My worldview was completely set at that point. And I noticed that there were a few things about, like, that I believed. I mean, and I'm not just talking about, like, politics kind of stuff. I mean, I just noticed that there were a few things that I believed that weren't consistent with what all of my new Christian friends in this church that I was going to, what they believed and what they valued. And so I kind of just kept my mouth shut about a couple of those issues and just, you know, I recognized this wasn't a popular opinion, and so I just didn't talk about it. And so we go on like that for a few years, and I go off to Harvard for graduate school. Now, Harvard is not the most friendly place to Christians, just so you know. And I was sold out enough in my faith at the time that I really had wanted God to transform me. And so in most cases, when we were having classroom debates about things, the classes were usually 60 people. And there were usually about 55 people on one side of the spectrum, and about five of us who came from a more faith-based, conservative, perspective on the other side. You know, there was a conservative Orthodox Jew. There were several of us from the Christian Fellowship. But it was usually about 55-5. Then comes the day we talk about one of those issues, and really the main one at that point that was still kind of hanging out there in my head that I felt really strongly about. And then came that day, and suddenly there's 56 people on this side of the room and 4 on this side. And at the end of the class, I was outside talking to, at the lockers, talking to one of my friends from the Christian Fellowship, and he said very gently, you know, Shanti, I didn't know you believe this. I'm like, yeah, Scott, I know it's not a very popular opinion in the Christian community. And he didn't yell. He didn't try to convince me. He just said, have you prayed about that? No, Scott, I haven't prayed about it. And he's like, why don't you pray about it? That was it. So I walk up the street, leave that building, walk up the street, and as I'm walking up Massachusetts Avenue, I'm like, okay, Lord, see, here's the thing. This is my big prayer, right? Here's the thing, Lord. I just don't believe this. I just don't agree. But you are perfectly capable of changing my mind if I'm wrong. Perfectly capable. And I just kept walking. Okay, this is my big prayer, right? So I walk another couple of blocks to where I was part of a Christian a cappella singing group, and we had a rehearsal, and I walk into the apartment, and there's a face at the door. Do any of you have a friend who's kind of a female John the Baptist, by the way? You know what I'm talking about? Okay, so this friend of mine is like a female John the Baptist, and her face is right at the door. She was waiting for me. And do you mind if I say what she actually said? Like, I'm not going to give you the sweet Christianese version, if that's all right. Because this was the first experience I'd ever had with something this intense like this. And I open the door, she's there, and I'm like, ah! And she said, I have a message for you. Do you want to hear it? I don't know. She pulled me into the bedroom of the apartment, and she sat me down on the bed, and she stuck her finger in my face. I mean, like, seriously intense, stuck her finger in my face and says, the Lord says to you, I mean, none of this, I have this feeling that there's something I'm supposed to share, but please take it for, you know, pray about it. None of that. The Lord says to you, you have given me your heart, but not your mind. I want your mind. 5 minutes before, I had prayed, I just don't agree, but Lord, you're perfectly capable of changing my mind if I'm wrong. 5 minutes later, the Lord says to you, you have given me your heart, but not your mind. I want your mind. And of course, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. You know, and I didn't realize I was withholding a part of myself that I didn't want to have my eyes open, that I was... There was something that I wasn't giving the Lord permission to do or to speak to me about something. So I was so convicted and just prayed right there. I was weeping and I just said, I'm so sorry, Lord. Absolutely. Here's my mind. I don't mean to withhold part of myself from you. Change my mind. If there's any area that needs to be changed, open my eyes. And there is no human explanation for what happened next, except that I walked out of that room believing something completely different than when I walked in. There's no human explanation for that. That's my challenge as the first step for us tonight, because I'm going to tell you some of what, I'm going to gallop through a bunch of things that I found in the research. But if we don't have our eyes opened, essentially our whole lives, we have had certain ideas about, for example, something about how men are wired or something that our kids need or something we've heard from them, and we view it through this lens and we don't realize that some of those assumptions, some of those views, some of those beliefs are wrong. And sometimes not just a little wrong, but like a lot wrong. And we just don't know it. The wool has been pulled over our eyes. Sometimes the enemy of our souls really loves that and loves to make us misunderstand things. So can we just stop for a minute and pray? If you guys agree, just do this business with the Lord of let's just take a second and say, God, open my eyes to things that I need to see, okay? Lord, I'm grateful for a chance to share this evening with these women. And Lord, right now I just ask that you speak to us and that we would hear you. Lord, unstop our ears. Open our eyes to the things that we need to see. Open our ears to the things we need to hear. And Lord, most of all, we give you permission to change our minds if there's any areas that need to be changed. Lord, help us to be able to be the women that you want us to be for the men in our lives, the kids in our lives, for the people that you've put in our path around us, in every aspect of our lives. We thank you for the chance to serve you, and we ask that you would help us do that well. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. God will take you up on that, by the way, just FYI. So that's the first thing, is to recognize you don't know what you don't know, and there's some things that maybe you've had wrong assumptions about the way somebody's thinking or why they're saying a certain thing that they do. So give God permission ongoing to open your eyes, and he will. You'll start seeing things in a different way. What's the second thing sort of that I had, that if I kind of had to identify the most important things? The second thing that I realized is kind of the next step in that is we talked about talking to God and getting our relationship there and God speaking to us. Next thing, let's talk about our men. And I know that not everybody in here is married. I know we have some single parents. Most single parents that I've met have an open heart to the possibility of God bringing them another person into their life in years to come. So just take that, if that's you and you're not actually married, take that as a future thing. Or maybe you're looking back and thinking, what went wrong there? And is there anything I can learn? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But the second thing is to recognize that there are some vast differences between men and women that absolutely get in the way of the kind of relationship that we want. Because it turns out that men are wired so differently in some ways, and not in every way, by the way. Don't hear me say that everything is different. But they're wired, literally the brain wiring between men and women is so different in some ways that there's a few areas that, to me, are tripping points. There's a few areas that tend to, usually do, get in the way. I'm going to give you two of those. I could talk about this all night. This is the study that I did of men. When I say studies, by the way, for those of you who don't know, each of my books is basically a published version of a giant research study that took anywhere from 2 to 4 years. And in this case, this was, for women only, was studying thousands of men, including a big nationally representative survey. They always culminate with a big, one or more big representative surveys, in order to test this is what I've been learning. Is this true? And how many men does this apply to? What percentage of men? Or if you're talking about kids, what percentage of kids does this apply to? And so there are always going to be exceptions. If 75% of men said one way, by definition, 25 didn't, right? Everybody's an individual. The key is to learn whether this applies to the man in your life. So let me give you just two of the seven things that we found about men that make a huge difference. Number one, is to recognize that your man feels about himself very, very differently than he looks. We think men look so confident in themselves. And when I first moved to Atlanta, I moved down here from New York, right? I'm completely a Manhattan girl at heart. I moved down here from New York, and I hear all these women in the Southern accent say, you know, it's my job to keep him humble. And I'm like, okay, seriously? Like, this is a new experience for me. And I realized it's just an outward sign of something that we don't realize as women. We think men are so confident in themselves. We think, you know what? He's a little too confident in himself. He could be taken down a peg or two, right? And we talk about the male ego. And all of that, it turns out, is a sham. It is a surface. It is not how they feel about themselves on the inside. And on the inside, there is something very different going on. The average guy goes through his day, and when I say the average guy, no matter how we ask this on the survey, it always came out to be about 75 to 80% of men. So the average guy goes through his day with this feeling like, you know, I want to tackle a challenge. You know, I want to do great things. I want to be a great husband. I want to be a great father. You know, I want to be a great provider or a great salesman or a great little league coach or whatever it is that he's putting his hand to do. I want to be great at that, but I'm really not sure I know exactly what I'm doing, and I hope nobody finds out. And there is a very, very deep sense of self-doubt underneath the surface of most men, a very deep insecurity, a very deep vulnerability that we don't even know is there. And it's basically like, the best way I can describe it is it's basically like a raw nerve. And you can hit the nerve without having any idea that that's what you're doing, and certainly never wanting to hit the nerve. Because here's what happens when you hit that insecurity nerve, when you hit that vulnerability, there is one message that is being sent. No matter what you're doing, no matter what you're saying, which you usually would not intend to, you're sending the message, I think you are inadequate. That's the message. I think you are inadequate. Now, why does this matter? Let's go back to the fact that guys are insecure in ways that we absolutely don't think could possibly be the case. When I was doing the studies on men and women, teenage boys and teenage girls, I saw in every age from age 15 up to age 75, that's where we did the surveys, age 15 to 75, every age, girls and later as women, our insecurities, we have insecurities too, but that doesn't tend to be one of them. Ours kind of sound like this question inside, which probably most women in the room know the feeling of, this question of, am I lovable? Am I special? Am I beautiful? That's the question in our hearts. That's the doubt. That's the vulnerability. Am I worthy of being loved for who I am on the inside? So we want to feel loved and cherished and adored, and that is what lights us up. For the guys and later the men, they're kind of like, that's important and everything, but not the big deal. And for them, for the boys and later as the men, the question in their hearts is completely different. It's this question of, am I able? Am I adequate? Am I any good at what I do on the outside? Rather than, am I worthy of being loved for who I am on the inside? For a guy, the doubt is, am I any good at what I do on the outside? And they are so sensitive to this feeling that I'm not good enough for her. I'm not a good enough husband. I'm not a good enough dad. If the heart cry of a woman is, am I lovable? The heart cry of a man is, do I measure up? And he's looking to the people around him for the answer to that question. And the most important person he's looking to is you. It's not the only one, but it's certainly the most important one. And that question is that raw nerve. Do I measure up? And so if you see him get angry sometimes, what did I say? And you're like, what was that? Be assured, it is very likely that you hit that nerve and sent that message, no, you don't measure up. In fact, I think you're an idiot. No, you don't measure up. You know, you're no good at doing that. For us, it's like no big deal. But for him, it is so painful because that is the doubt in his heart that matters. So what do we do in order to find that thing that will help make the relationship completely different? Basically, it's learn what sends that signal that I think you're inadequate. Learn that and avoid hitting that nerve where you can. Say something completely differently, and I'll give you an example in a minute. And a positive version of that is do the positive and do the things that will send the positive message to him of that sense of appreciation. This is why you've heard that women are so angled towards needing to feel loved and men are so angled towards needing to feel respected. You guys have heard this, right? This is why. Because for them, feeling she respects me is the answer to that do I measure up question. Yes, I do. She thinks I do. So let me give you an example because I always learn better from examples. I was on the plane flying back. We were about to film the DVD study on For Women Only and For Men Only on the new editions of the books that we put out last year. And I interview every guy I've come across, so I kind of feel bad for whoever's trapped next to me on the airplane for 2 hours. And because it's really good data, you know, because they don't know who you are and you don't know who they are. They could be completely honest. It's really kind of fun. So I have the best opening line in the world, by the way, when someone says, "What do you do?" And I say, "I help women understand men." And it leads to a pretty fun conversation. And so I said, "I help women understand men." He's like, "What are you telling them about us?" There's a suspicion. And I explained some of the things. And I saw this guy. I saw his shoulders just slump. You know, you see somebody who looks just really defeated, right? So I see this body language. He just looks so defeated. And he starts talking and sharing some of these things. And he said a phrase that I had heard many times in previous years from Jeff, and I had no idea what Jeff was talking about before I started this research. And I guarantee that some of the women in the room have heard this phrase and didn't know what your guy was talking about either. And he said, "I love my wife, but nothing I do is ever good enough for her." Okay? I just heard Jeff say things like that. "I feel like nothing I do is ever good enough for you." What are you talking about? So I said, I thought I knew by now what this guy was talking about. So I said, can you give me an example? And he said, "I'll just tell you something that happened last night." And he said, "My wife, we had friends over for dinner. The kitchen was a wreck. She had to go out for a meeting. And she said, 'You know, honey, would you be willing to just clean the kitchen while I'm out so that we can go straight to bed when I get home?'" And he said, "Yeah, sure, no problem." He said, so I did the dishes, cleaned the kitchen. And she comes home from the meeting and she kisses me on the cheek and looks over my shoulder into the kitchen and goes, and grabs a sponge and starts re-cleaning all the countertops. And he said, "It just kills me. Nothing I do is ever good enough for her." Now, I can see from some of your faces that you're having the same thought that I did the first 20 times I heard something like this, which roughly translated can be like, grow up, get over it. You know, you kind of have, we sort of have this feeling like that shouldn't bother you. And finally, after I heard man after man after man share examples like that, something finally clicked and I realized, wait a minute, I'm saying that shouldn't bother you because it wouldn't bother me. He's not me. He's wired very differently by a God who knew what he was doing. And think about how, when you look at the curse, how are men and women affected? Look at what God says is going to happen in Eve's life. It's like your desire is going to be for your husband, like to know that he loves you. But the translation is really your desire is to be your control, your husband. That's kind of one of the things that's our sinful tendency. But he'll always have a tendency to rule over you, that you're always going to be kind of insecure about, does he really love me? The guy, the curse, God says, you're always going to be toiling the land by the sweat of your brow, and you're always going to feel like the thorns and thistles are rising up against you. Like no matter what you do, it's never good enough. No matter how hard you work, you don't cut it. And that is, just so you know, that insecurity, that raw nerve, that feeling of inadequacy, that is the reason for this guy. His wife was saying, "Oh, thanks for trying to clean the kitchen, but it wasn't good enough." In his mind, that's what she was saying. And I asked him, what could she have done instead? And this is where we get to the positive. And I have been searching for years to try to find out what is it that is the highest leverage, biggest difference maker in what we can say on the positive side to our husbands. Because, okay, this is kind of embarrassing, but I learned all this stuff about men being insecure, needing respect. And you know how we women love to hear, "I love you," and it says like 10 different things? It's not just, I have affection for you, but it says, when a guy says, "I love you," it's like, you're mine. Like, it says a bunch of different things, right? So I had learned that Jeff needed respect, so I started following him around the house, and, "Oh, honey, I respect you so much," you know, and After a while, poor Jeff was like, okay, time out. It just doesn't have the same ring to it. I mean, I appreciate it and everything, but it just doesn't. And I've been on a quest for the last 8 years to try to figure out what is it that says that same emotional impact to a guy that I love you is to a girl. And I finally found it. In the research for the last book, for those of you who were at the Marriage Hour last year where I did the Surprising Secrets of Highly Happy Marriages research before the book came out, don't ruin the surprise for the other women in the room. If you were there, you've heard this before. But I finally found statistically what it is that you can say to a guy that has that emotional impact. Can anybody guess what it is? It's a little phrase. Come on. Okay, you cheated. For those of you who guessed thank you, that's it. Saying thank you to a guy is the emotional equivalent of I love you to you, believe it or not. And it's thank you for cleaning the kitchen. This is what the guy said when I said, what could she have said that was different? And he said, it would have made such a difference if my wife just would have said thank you for cleaning the kitchen while I was out. He's like, if I miss the crumbs under the toaster, she can always clean them later when I'm not looking, right? And I had not realized, and this was for years, I hadn't realized that I could say thank you to Jeff and then add this thing that to him was like, but it wasn't good enough. Thanks for mowing the lawn, honey. Thank you so much. But you know what? You missed a spot over there. And we think we're just trying to help, right? And we don't realize what you did. What we're saying is, am I able? Am I adequate? Am I any good at what I do on the outside? What you did on the outside wasn't good enough. And the key is to recognize, you know what? If he missed the spot, he will notice, believe it or not, because he's so attuned. Because back to the self-doubt, this is a self-doubt in the heart of every man. So that sense of respect and affirmation, and that thank you for the little things every day, oh my goodness, it will absolutely change your home. The second thing about in the research about men that I just want to mention, which I feel like any discussion of the high leverage things that matter to men, if it doesn't mention sex, it's kind of missing something. So let me just address the subject really briefly. Talk about a misunderstanding. We have a huge misunderstanding when it comes to, we have no clue what physical intimacy means to our husbands. We completely misunderstand it. We think it's primarily a physical need for him. That's sort of the category we put it in. And it's like, you know what? It's a physical need. It's a physical urge. And you know, I've got, you know, as I said, I've got, you know, younger kids. A lot of you have even younger kids. And when you've been pulled on by little hands all day, sleep seems like a physical need too, right? Can I get an amen or something? Okay. And I hadn't realized until I started to ask the men, okay, deep breath, what is the importance of this in your life? And I started to ask them that question. What I heard from the men had nothing to do with the physical. Nothing. What I kept hearing was entirely this enormous emotional need that they couldn't get met any other way. And so, ladies, here's what the need is. It's the need that every man has to feel that his wife desires him and that she wants him. And if a guy feels that, it gives him this sense of confidence, actually, and this sense of well-being in all of these other areas of his life. It's not just about the bedroom. It's about how he feels about himself. Back to that self-doubt. It's one very powerful way of saying you do measure up. And it salves, it soothes that self-doubt in all these other areas of his life. And conversely, by the way, the opposite is also true, just FYI. If he doesn't feel desired, if he feels like it's really easy for her to say, you know what, honey, I'm just really tired, it gives him this dragging sense of depression almost and this lack of well-being in all of the other areas of his life, because the guys told me that they're basically thinking, I'm so undesirable, I can't even compete with her pillow, right? Like, okay, that's really depressing. because the guys, they're wired very differently, as you know. And for men, you know, Jeff has said, the way he put it, and I'm going to say what Jeff actually said, and I've heard this now from other men. He's like, look, we guys, we think if I was enough of a stud, she wouldn't be tired. That's the message you get from the movies, right? He's like, I can be really exhausted, but if you show any interest, I'll rally. And so just so you know, that what we see as a physical need and honestly sometimes a demand, and it's like, ugh, so optional. Realize that for most men, it's this huge emotional thing for them. So just so you guys know, I could go on about that subject all day long. Okay, so let's switch and talk about item number three. That was item number two about the things, you know, the highest leverage things I wanted you to know about understanding kind of this inner life of your man. Realize that he's very different on the inside than what you see on the outside. And speak to the inner guy. Learn the inner man. And it'll completely change your relationship. Okay, third, same thing about your kids. What is going on in the heart of your children is not always what you think. And learn to look for the signals of what's actually going on inside and learn a couple of key truths. And we don't have time to cover all of them, but this was a study. This was my most scary study. I did this nationally representative survey of teenagers. The study was actually studying kids at all ages. I couldn't actually legally survey anyone under the age of 15. So I only surveyed 15, 16, and 17-year-olds. But the book and the rest of the study was for kids of all ages. How many of you have really young children, like under school age? Okay. How many of you have elementary school kids? How many of you have middle school kids? A few. How many of you have high schoolers? Okay, and after high school? Okay, there's some of you I've noticed. I've noticed somebody keeps hands going up. All right, so this for those of you who have the kids who are under the age, under about teenagers, those of you who have tweens, like middle school-ish age, you're going to start seeing this stuff come up, all pop up all around you. Those of you who have high schoolers, it's in your face every day. Those of you who have younger kids, some of this is going to apply, but a lot of it is going to be so you are prepared to see it when it happens. When I did this study, my kids were 3 and 6. And literally every now and then, I'm sorry, it cracks me up because I'm studying what kids think and all this stuff that's going on the inside. And literally my daughter would wake up in the morning and say something and something would happen. I'd be like, there's chapter 4, okay? It just popped up. So a lot of this is about knowing something in advance. It has been life-changing for me and Jeff to know some of this stuff in advance. So this is this first thing real quickly that is going to apply mostly to those of you who have teenagers and preteens, middle school and high school. So let me just tell you briefly. We get to the point when kids get to be about 10, 11, 12-ish, we start really getting stressed about who is a greater influence on our kids. Is it parents or is it peers? At that, you know, at this point of change, who has the greatest influence? And I realized once I started doing this study of all these kids, we're asking completely the wrong question. Because it turns out the answer is neither. The greatest influence by far on a teenager and even down into some of the tween years, the greatest influence is the influence of freedom. It's not any one person. It's not parents. It's not peers, believe it or not. It's the influence of freedom. And I can see some of you like, okay. So let me give you an example. Some of you will have heard this many times in your house, and some of you are lucky enough not to be there yet. But we were interviewing a teenager. We would walk. My co-author Lisa Rice and I would walk to the mall into the mall with fistfuls of $5 Starbucks gift cards. And we would go with paper surveys and clipboards and interview questions and just interview kids, no names, just social research. And if they answered the questions and spent, you know, 5 minutes with us, we'd just give them a $5 Starbucks gift card. It's amazing how much you can learn. And so this one kid, perfect example, he was so tense about something. We were talking about his parents or something, and he's like, I just get so mad when my mom takes away my cell phone. She can't do that. That's my cell phone. And of course, I'm like, did your mom pay for the cell phone? Yeah, but that's not the point. It's my cell phone. And we started hearing this over and over and over and over and over, and we couldn't figure out. It's like, there is something going on under that, and I need to figure out what it is. We ended up, in this case, we ended up consulting this adolescent psychotherapist, and she said, here's what it is, because we'd heard this hundreds of times, and we tested this on the survey, and this is what's going on. She said, what is going on is the influence of freedom. Freedom is like cocaine to a teenager. It's intoxicating, and it's addictive. It feels so good. They want more and more of this amazing feeling of freedom, and they are scared of losing it. They're terrified of losing it. What this cell phone kid is basically saying is, don't you take away my freedom. Don't you take away my drug, right? Now, unlike cocaine, getting more freedom and building into that is healthy, and it's what we're supposed to be going towards. But here's what it feels like to the kids. And as we started exploring this, it was fascinating that we did not realize what was going on underneath the surface of our kids. Is basically, think about it, put yourself in their shoes if you can for just a second. You're a kid, your whole life, you've had to ask mom and dad for stuff. Mom, can I have the candy bar at the grocery store? No, honey, you've had too much sugar, I'm sorry. Okay. And then a year or two later, mom, can I mowed the lawn for the neighbor, and so I have $5. Can I buy the candy bar with my own money? You know what? Why don't you go ahead? You make that decision for yourself. I can decide to buy the candy bar. It's like this huge thing. So he buys the candy bar, and it's this like little inching, the step of freedom. I can make my own decision with my own money. And then comes the day that he can drive himself to the grocery store. Now, imagine that feeling of stepping into freedom. And more, your whole life, you've not been able to do anything without your parents. And suddenly, you can do it for yourself. And and this is the way one kid said, when I got my cell phone, I felt like a real person for the first time. Now imagine how scary it would be to feel like a real person and being afraid of losing that. And now here's the thing, we don't have time to go into great detail, but here, just so you guys know, especially those of you whose kids aren't quite there yet, this is often this fear of losing this amazing, precious feeling of freedom. Kids will do anything to keep that feeling and to keep that freedom. And they'll sometimes make really stupid decisions. And they'll try to hide and cover up things. They'll lie sometimes. And it looks to us like rebellion. And sometimes it is, don't get me wrong. Sometimes there is a bad heart, a rebellious heart. But all too often, it's not, it's fear. And I love, there's something Andy Stanley said a number of years ago. I loved it. He said, you parent a fearful child very differently than you parent a rebellious child. And it's true. So that's my first challenge about this for you, is look to see where this desire for freedom is starting to bubble up, and parent looking at whether it's a true heart of rebellion or whether it's actually fear. And here's the thing that will start to become more and more and more important as your kids get older and older, is from the young ages up into about the middle school ages, and then certainly by the time you hit high school, it's completely there. Use the loss of freedom as the nuclear bomb of discipline. because that is how kids view it. Have you ever imposed a discipline and seen your kids just go crazy in ways you're like, this is completely inappropriate. You're completely overreacting. Are they? You're thinking like a parent who has all that freedom. Think about it like a kid. For them, losing that freedom is a nuclear bomb of infraction, and you apply it for stuff that they didn't think was a nuclear bomb infraction. You know, they stayed out late. That's not a nuclear bomb infraction. Give me chores or something. Okay? Don't take away my most precious freedom. Let me give you an example. So Lisa and I, her teenage daughter, got into a little accident in a parking lot because she was talking on her cell phone. And that was a big rule that they had, all these young drivers. While we were doing this study, Lisa had four teenagers in her house. So she was kind of my guinea pig for everything. And her daughter had backed into a car in a parking lot because she was breaking a rule, talking on her cell phone, and she tried to downplay it. This is another thing kids will do to try to lose freedom. Like, Mom, you may not even need to come down here. It's just a little boo-boo with a light bulb. So, of course, she goes down there, and she finds that her daughter has done $960 worth of damage to this lady's front end of her car. So she was about to say, okay, you lose your cell phone for 2 weeks, you know, and then she thought, wait a minute. We had been doing this research. She had since found out that her daughter's primary freedom for her wasn't the car, it wasn't these other things, it was her cell phone. That was for her, her primary freedom. And her primary freedom trigger or whatever. And so Lisa and her husband Eric talked about it and they said, you know what, we're gonna do something a little bit different because was this rebellion or was this stupidity? And this really was kind of stupidity, okay? So Sarah, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna give you a choice. So you have a choice. You can either lose your cell phone for 2 weeks, or, you know, the summer is about to start. They were right at the end of the school year, and she was going to be working at a movie theater for $7.50 an hour over the summer. She said, or you can work all summer at your little movie theater job and earn almost no money for yourself to pay back the entire $960. So which would you rather do? And Sarah says, I'll work all summer. I won't take any money for myself. I'll give you all my paychecks. Just don't make me lose my cell phone for 2 weeks. Okay, that's psychotic. Just from a parent's perspective. But from her perspective, that seemed proportional. To work all summer and earn no money for herself to pay this back seemed more proportional than losing her cell phone for 2 weeks. I thought that was a great example of learn your child's key freedom triggers and use the loss of them as a nuclear bomb of discipline for nuclear bomb infractions. There came a day about a year later when there was truly a rebellion issue and there was truly a heart issue with that daughter, and her parents had to use the nuclear bomb, and it seemed proportional to her. So that's a big one, be aware of. Another one, which for you, any person in here, this will apply to, any child, for me, I saw it starting about the age of 5-ish, 6-ish, and it applies to both boys and girls, is understand what listening means to them and how to listen to a child in a way that they feel listened to. Because I guarantee every woman in here has heard, you're just not listening to me, okay? And you usually hear it after you've been listening for 10 minutes, right? What's going on? What's going on is that to feel listened to, you have to set aside the issue. And when you see a child, and it happens at any age, you know how there's so much emotion, and especially when you get into the preteen and the teen years when the hormones get involved, there's so much emotion. It's almost like you take a rubber band and you twist it and you twist it and you twist it and it gets all tense and kinked up. And you see all of this and you're like, we're not going to get anywhere with this. And so you try to be very cool, very calm, and you kind of try to get all the emotions set aside so you can deal with whatever it is that's the issue. And instead, often it gets worse. You're just not listening to me. And instead, so like this happened with my daughter recently where she was talking about a teacher who embarrassed her in front of the class. And oh my goodness, she was so upset. And I'm like, I'm going to call them. I'm going to email them. I'm going to set up a meeting. I was so mad. And she's like, you're not listening to me. I'm like, what? Okay. And then I remembered, okay, chapter six. And I realized what she most wants me to listen to are her feelings. All those things that I'm trying to kind of set aside so I can deal with the problem are those feelings, those jangling emotions are what she most wants me to listen to. How many of you have told your husband, I don't want you to fix it, I just want you to listen? It's the same thing with our kids. We tell the men, and for men only, and we do marriage conference, we tell the men to listen to your wives. You need to set aside the problem for a minute. Filter the problem out and focus in on all those jangling emotions. That is what she most wants you to enter into. And it is the same exact thing with our kids, whether they are boys or girls. By the way, boys had the same exact numbers all the way up through high school. I don't know when boys turn into these men that just want to fix it, but up through the age of 17, they answered the same as the girls. And by the way, those of you who want your boys to talk to you, can I just give you a tip? How many of you have big, tall teenage boys and you kind of want them to talk more? Here's a little tip, by the way, just as a quick thing that'll help you get more communication with them. This will help you with your husband too, by the way. It turns out, I learned this recently, it's not in the book because I just learned this a few years ago. Neurologically, with a woman, eye-to-eye contact and conversation releases oxytocin, which is a bonding hormone, and it makes you feel close to this person and connected in conversation. With a man, eye-to-eye contact triggers the fight or flight centers. Including with boys. So instead of releasing oxytocin, it's like, deer in the headlights, okay? And I have to decide whether this is a challenge that I need to fight or I need to flee, okay? And so if you want to have a good conversation often with your husband, but certainly with your son, when he comes in the door, instead of, how was your day? Fine. What'd you do? Nothing. Okay. Instead, be cooking. How was your day? And he'll start talking. Side-to-side communication is absolutely critical for boys. This is why your son won't talk to you in person when you're in the kitchen, but you'll be side-by-side in the car. Have you ever noticed this? And they start chattering. Well, chattering may be too big of a word, but you know what I mean. That's why, just FYI, if you want your son to talk to you, learn that side-to-side thing. Okay, so listening. Remember the freedom triggers. Remember the power of listening to their feelings, entering in. Honey, I'm so sorry that he embarrassed you in front of the class. Did you feel like the other kids were laughing at you? And you may feel like, okay, she is so emotional. There's such drama queen going on right now. That would be like taking gasoline and throw it on the fire, right? Make it even worse. It doesn't. It basically, what it does is allow her to talk it out and that rubber band gets unkinked and loosened up. And you'll see it, I promise, you'll see it if you start pulling out the feelings rather than trying to shunt them aside. Okay, so those are two things about the kids that make a huge difference once we're aware of them. Final couple of things. Fourth thing. From the studies that we did, it was really interesting to see how easy it is for every one of us, even if we are not trying to let our mom selves overwhelm our wife selves. And you guys were talking about this to a degree earlier. And let me tell you something that was powerful from the For Parents Only research about the kids. We talked to them and did the surveys on what created the greatest security for them. And it didn't surprise me as a believer, but it surprised many other people to find out that the kids who were the most insecure, the least happy, were the ones who felt like their parents were putting them ahead of the marriage. A lot of people think, if I put the kids first and focus on them and spend a lot of my time on their activities and driving them around, they'll feel loved. And they do. But if the kids see that that comes at the expense of mom and dad just don't spend much time together, I don't see them sitting together on the couch talking. I don't see them having together time. If they don't see that, the certainty and the security that they need that that marriage is going to be intact starts to crumble a little bit. And those are the kids who are the least secure, the ones who feel like basically they're in charge of the family because they're the ones who everything revolves around as a child. I was fascinated by that because that's basically a 12-year-old or a 9-year-old or a 16-year-old who basically says, wait, I'm kind of running the family. It's all about me. That's kind of insecure. I don't know what I'm doing. How can I be the one running the family? That's what it feels like. That's why it's insecure. They want the adult to run the family. One of the ways to do that, and when I was doing the research for the same book that I found the thank you thing on the survey of men, the book is called The Surprising Secrets of Highly Happy Marriages. I don't have a copy up here with me, but it was basically a study of what are the most happily married couples doing differently. If you survey the most happily married people, what is it that these people are doing? What's the secret sauce, right? And one of the things that I found, it seemed so simple, I almost missed it in the survey. And here's what it is. These couples, one of the things that these couples did differently than everybody else was they actively, but sometimes subtly, prioritized their friendship as husband and wife. It turns out that there have been studies on what is the greatest predictor of friendship. What is it that if you have people in a group, what is it that makes them most likely to be friends? And the studies, I would have thought, would have found things like, you know, shared interests make people more likely to be friends, or shared personality, you know, personalities that are complementary. And all of those things were important, but they paled in comparison to the most important predictor of friendship. And it matters to friends, and it matters to a husband and wife. Can anybody guess what it is? Geographic proximity. Geographic proximity is the greatest predictor of friendship because you spend the most time with the people that you see the most often. All of us have had really, really close friends move away. And you may love them, you may try to stay in touch, but you just aren't as close as you once were. It works the same way with husband and wife. And we found that these couples, it wasn't even that they were doing date nights, although certainly that was important. That wasn't the only thing that mattered, though. We found that these couples were just as strong and just as tight if they never did date nights, but they found other ways to be together. I'll tell you, one husband and wife, they looked at they were feeling very distant. They'd been starting to argue all the time. And here's one of the success factors. When couples like this start to argue, and when any of us get into a difficult season in our relationship, it's really easy and it's very tempting to try to avoid the conflict by avoiding each other. Because if you don't see each other and talk, you can't have the conflict. And what that means is now you're spending less time together. And so this couple, this one wife I was talking to, they had recognized they'd gotten into a bad rut. They were starting to argue all the time. They weren't feeling close. And she looked at their schedule and she realized that because they had 3 kids and they were doing all different activities, they realized that literally the only times they ever saw each other was when they were getting the kids ready for school in the morning and late at night after all the activities were done, when they kind of were exhausted and crashing into bed at night, and they figured they were probably getting 10, 15 minutes of conversation maybe. And so what she said is, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I recognize that, you know, Saturdays, when my husband takes Johnny to soccer on Saturday morning, there is no reason why I have to put the baby in to the van and bring, you know, Mary and jump in the van and ride to soccer. As a matter of fact, I'd prefer not to, but that's 20 minutes in the car on the way there and 20 minutes in the car on the way back. that's 40 minutes that I wouldn't get with my husband otherwise. And so she stopped, okay, I'll stay home and vacuum. You know, she started just jumping in the car, and they started trying to do these little, grab these little moments together. And it started transforming things for them because they were spending just more time together and were able to catch up. It can be those littlest things. Sometimes for some of us, we have to prioritize date nights because that's the only way it's going to happen, right? But that's not the only option. So just so you know, prioritizing your friendship with your spouse as the primary thing that you're prioritizing will help your kids feel more secure. You have to put them in that order. So that's number four. Number five, and the last one. I don't know why I keep looking at my bracelet as if it's a watch. Keep doing this. That's not going to tell me anything. Okay, because we got to get to the questions and answers. The fifth thing, there's no need to be waiting for the other shoe to drop. There's no need to be kind of halfway suspicious and halfway like worried that things are going to fall apart. It turns out what your heart most needs to hear, what you're most concerned about, that question of, does he really love me? You know, am I any good as a mom? It turns out that what you most need is to walk and live in the reality that what you most need to hear is what is the most true, even if it doesn't feel like it sometimes. When we did the surveys of the men, at the end, after the multiple choice questions, I gave the guys a blank space. And I said, we've had all these multiple choice things. What's the one most important thing you wish your wife knew but feel you can't explain to her or tell her? And I thought it was going to be a list of things, you know, and I was going to rank their importance. And instead, when I got the spreadsheets back, I could hardly believe it, because the top answer by far, blank space, they could have said anything. The top answer by far, the one most important thing I wish my wife knew is how much I love her. And these are men who often say, I don't know how to get it across in a way that she'll believe me, you know, and I know I don't always do the best job, but that's how I feel. And so stepping into this belief of that, and this is one of the most important areas you can ask God to open your eyes, is to help you see that that is how your husband feels about you. So critical. We found that on the other surveys as well. So absolutely critical. And for our kids, we spend all this time, and for those of you who don't have the preteens or the teens yet, it can get really insecure. Sometimes you can wonder, am I doing a good job? Sometimes they can say some pretty harsh things. And on the survey, the kids were really honest and they said some pretty harsh things. And it was kind of painful to hear some of it. And when I got to the last question on the survey, I asked the kids, after all the multiple choice questions, I asked these teenagers, if you only had today with your parents, what's the one thing that you most think that they need to know or would need to know about you or that they don't know, some phrase like that. And again, I was thinking I'd get a laundry list of things that, okay, I wish they would have done this or I wish they knew this. And instead, when I pulled up the spreadsheet on my computer after the survey was finished, and these surveys are all these big, expensive, nationally representative surveys, so it took a while to do it. And I finally got it in, and I pulled that up, and I called Lisa, my co-author. I called her on the phone, and we couldn't talk. We were sobbing on the phone because almost 100%, and it wasn't sadly 100%, it was like 99.6 or something, but almost 100% of the kids, every single comment was something like, I wish my parents would know that how much I love them and how much I appreciate them and how I'm sorry I am that I've been such a brat. And the fact that I see the sacrifice they make for me, and I know I don't share it, and I know I don't look like it, and I know I look like I'm too cool for school, but that's not how I feel. And I see everything they've done for me. And when I grow up, I'm going to parent just like them. And we were sobbing because we don't see that from our kids, but that's how they feel about us. That's what our hearts need as moms and as wives. for those of us who are married. That's what we need to know. And we can relax into that, ladies. I pray that you would allow God to open your eyes to the truth of that. Because once you stop being suspicious about that, once you stop waiting for the other shoe to drop and kind of suspecting that that isn't true, you can just truly step into the peace that God has for you as a parent and as a wife. So I those would be my high leverage things for you, my five things. And I know we're very short on time, but I'd love to take some questions if we have them. And I know we have questions in here. So shout them on out. Gail has a mic, but don't just need a mic. Be brave.
Are y'all all processing still?
Yeah. It's a great question. For those of you who didn't quite hear that, is their greatest fear is being inadequate, and how do you handle it in areas where they might actually be inadequate? Okay, so here's the big thing. Most guys are very sensitive, as you can imagine, to, for example, my husband for years, his dad is a total handyman, and Jeff was not at all. And he was actually kind of sensitive about that. And I had no idea that the first way to handle that is be really careful how you talk about it, especially in public. Because he would say something like, oh, you know, the kitchen sink broke. We'd be out with friends. And he'd say something like, the kitchen sink broke. And, you know, I got to figure out how to fix it. And I'd kind of laugh in front of this group of people and say, you've never been able to fix the kitchen sink in your life. And he'd be like, okay. And I had no idea that was like, okay, here, let me slit your throat in front of everybody else. I mean, it's humiliating for an area that they feel like they're not the protector, provider, right? And so the first thing is recognize that that may be an area of sensitivity. Now, it also may be that they're kind of okay with it, that they know that they don't have time to do that because they're so busy with work or whatever, but still wish they could, right? The thing that I have found with my husband is I found that if there is an area that he wanted to be better in, like that, to recognize that I needed to encourage him in that and make him think that he could, actually. And sometimes it's not going to happen, right? But like Jeff, for example, he tried a bunch of home projects that didn't quite go so well, but he tried a bunch of home projects and he would go back to Home Depot and he'd constantly, and I, thank goodness I've been doing this research because he'd come home with completely the wrong tools. And I felt like the Holy Spirit had a bit of a bridle on my tongue. And he'd say, doggone it. You know, I didn't, you know, I'm sure you'll figure it out. And that's basically all I said. I felt like that's all I could say and should say. I'm sure you'll figure it out. Like kind of being the cheerleader and letting everything else go and being okay with the fact that like the molding is kind of crooked for a while and recognizing that, you know, it'll come, that there'll be a day he'll go, you know, the molding is crooked. And that he would, you know, either figure out how to do it himself or hire someone to do it. So it's really, truly, it's more about, Have you noticed it's really not what you say, it's how you say it? I mean, that's an example. That's just one example. Obviously, there's many. Okay, so little kids, the stuff that I was digging out was that kind of emotions-based stuff. And it's interesting. There is something that applies no matter how tiny the kids are, all the way up to teenagers, that so shocked me for the teenagers. It didn't so much shock me for the little ones, but it was, you know how your kids, it's really easy when they start throwing a temper tantrum. You have this choice like, okay, do I let them get away with it because I'm exhausted or do I put my foot down? And that same choice will eventually, as any parent of a teenager can tell you, that choice will eventually be the same choice as a 16-year-old. Do I let them do what they want to do because I'm exhausted with the arguing, or do I put my foot down? And it's interesting that even though we couldn't survey little ones, obviously, we found in the teenagers the same thing that matters to them, which is that it turns out they actually inside, they really want you to put your foot down. I know that sounds crazy. They really want you to be the parent. And that growing freedom, whether they're 1 and a half or whether they're 17 and a half, that growing freedom, they want it. Oh man, it's like cocaine. They want it. But they also know inside they're not quite ready to handle it yet. And there's a great sense of insecurity that comes from feeling like my parents are kind of letting me do whatever I want to do. And so we've seen that. I mean, everything the child psychologists say all the way up from every age. So just FYI. And somebody had a question over here. I heard, yeah. Oh, gosh. Okay, great question. How do you handle that with your kids if they're not quite doing it right? Okay, so this is something that has been, to me, an ongoing question, partly because now I've got a Petri dish at home now that I have a teenager. But it is so critical for kids to see you holding whatever standards you hold as a family. Okay, if it's something is important to you as a family, and it's important, for example, that the bed be made well, like I've told you, just tossing the blankets up isn't going to do it. You have to tuck in the sheets or whatever the standards are. If you have a standard, don't relax it just to make them feel good, because then that's not true affirmation. That's lowering your standards, right? Making the bed is a silly example, but think of how many things that applies to from grades on down, right? So lowering the standard doesn't help them make them feel any better. In fact, it goes back to this taking charge thing. They want the parent to be the parent and to enforce the rules, believe it or not. They'll kick and scream and fight, but they want that. What you absolutely have to do at the same time, though, is when they actually make a mistake, when there is something that they are inadequate at, when they make a stupid decision, when they get in trouble, they get the ticket, they get detention, they whatever those things are, they have to see mom and dad are enforcing the rules and there's consequences for this, but they're going to stand beside me while I go through it. That is so key emotionally to these kids. It's not that you change the standards, eliminate the consequences. It's the, you know, like my daughter, her school, the school, every student is given a tablet at the beginning of school year. And they're told you have to bring it to school. You know, you have to have it charged up and you have to have it because you do all this stuff on it throughout the day. And yesterday she forgot it. Now, I have two choices. I can either run it up to the school, which I'm tempted to do, or I can let her suffer the consequence. And she was so upset with herself. And she was so like, and what I needed to do was let her suffer the consequence, but sympathize and say, I'm so sorry. You know, I know you're going to have to do this thing with your teacher. I'll stay up with you tonight. Even though I didn't have to, it was her consequence, but that was it. It was she's going to suffer the consequence and I'm going to be there. Yeah, great question. Yes, the thing that a boy needs very much at this age, that question of do I measure up starts to become a real issue. The older a boy child gets, they start needing to hear thank you and I'm so proud of you as the earliest that you can possibly do it. That fills up their little male hearts, just like it does with girls, too. It's not like we don't need to feel our parents say, I'm proud of you. I mean, girls need that, too. But for a guy, guys live today in a really, really difficult culture. This culture is a male bashing, I think you are an adequate culture in every conceivable way. And they're surrounded with that right when they're developing their identity as a man. That do I measure up thing. And it breaks my heart as the mom of a son myself. And it is so imperative that we look for opportunities to build them up, to say I'm proud of you, to say thank you, to find ways to respect them, even if they're not going to do everything right. And sometimes that means drawing a bigger boundary than we might feel comfortable with as a mom. Like if your husband is saying, oh, let him try it. And your mom heart goes, oh, but it's dangerous, right? You know what? Maybe you should listen and let him try it. Because yeah, he might fail. Yeah, he might hurt himself. Yeah, he might not do well at whatever. But give him a chance to try and make the mistakes. And maybe He'll actually do something that you can praise in the middle of it. It is absolutely critical while they're developing their identity. Absolutely critical. Yeah. The fathers, one of the things that the father-daughter thing is, as the girl is growing up and asking that question, am I lovable? Am I special? Am I beautiful? Am I worthy of being loved? Obviously, as a young girl, the main person she's getting the answer from is her dad. And a lot of dads don't know how to answer that question. That's one way they feel very inadequate. Like, I have a girl child, right? I don't know what to do with this. And they may be completely in love with their daughter and have no idea how to relate to her. And so what I've found is, because most dads desperately love their little girl and feel desperately inadequate to know how to do that, it actively helps if you ever, and this has to be at some non-emotional time, by the way. This can't be after a big blow up because he didn't know how to speak to her. But at some non-emotional time, say, you know, would you like... I was just thinking, you know, now that she's getting to such and such an age, you know, you knew when she was twirling for you in the living room and saying, am I pretty? You knew to kind of say, you're so pretty. You know, that's easy. But now that she's, you know, 10, 11, 12 or whatever, do you want any ideas as a girl myself on some things that'll make her heart go, you know, go like that? And sometimes they won't want that right away. Let them process that question. If you ever do, let me know. Because guys process, you know, and they might come back to you. And one of the things that we have found works really well is when we urge the dad to recognize that that little girl twirling in the little living room is still there, even though she's 16 or whatever. And that connection she's longing to make with her dad, even if he'll text her messages every now and then, and kind of enter into her world, oh my goodness, you should see it. The girls show each other the text messages in the back of the car. Look what I got from my dad, you know. It's really special. We had one focus group where this one girl said she was on her way out that morning, and this was all teenage girls in this focus group, and she said on the way out the door, as the door is about to slam behind her, she heard her dad call out from the kitchen, "Bye, pretty girl." And then the door closed, and all the other girls in the focus group went, oh, you know? So, I mean, it can be really little stuff. Yeah. And Gail, what time is it? I'm like, or okay. You, keep on answering. You sure? But we have to do questions. All right. Okay. Okay. So, just FYI, and here's the big, it's easy to have this misunderstanding because I had it too. For every kid, freedom is going to look different. Some kids that I've talked to, their phone, they could care less. I mean, like my daughter's, one of her best girlfriends, she loses her phone like every other day. And, you know, my daughter's trying to text her and, oh yeah, I never did find that. I think I left it on the couch last week. You know, like it does not bother her at all. So that is not a freedom trigger for her, right? For her, it's a totally different thing. So it's not any one thing. It's not driving. It's not phone. It's not social media. It's not the, you know, particular group of friends. It's freedom. It's whatever that is for her or him. And I'm sorry, what was the second part of that question? You know what? That's a great question. She's saying, you know, aren't there some times if you have kids who really don't want that freedom? You know, kids are driving later and later now. Don't you want to kind of push them out of the nest, go get your license, you know, and I think actually that there is something to that. I don't actually know what's behind that. I'm very curious. That's another whole research study. It's a really good question though. I wish I knew the answer, but I can see that there's benefit to pushing them out of the nest. I don't know. I want to know why they're not leaving the nest in order to know how to do that. Yeah. I don't know. It's a really good question. Okay, we have two questions in the back there, at the table and then in the back. Okay. Hold on. Three. Okay, go ahead. Okay, so for boys, basically a man calls his son into life as a man. And one of the biggest problems, and I'm sorry if I blow anybody out of the water here, but for many of us as moms, Our biggest problem is that starting at the youngest ages, we stop our husband calling our son into life. Because we tell them how they should and shouldn't parent. And dads parent differently. And they parent sons differently than they parent daughters. And, you know, today in our kind of, I hate to say it, but kind of more politically correct culture, we call that socializing things. And, well, if he parented the son the way that you parented the daughter, then the boys would play with the Barbies. And no, actually, they found that's not true, right? They'd still play with the Barbies, but they ripped their head off and turned it into a gun. So, yeah, I mean, seriously, they've actually found this. So, for our husbands, honestly, the most important thing we can do is let them be the dad in the way they want to be. We've actually, they've found, boys and girls, by the way, in every culture around the world, anthropologists have found that a father will let a toddler child get three times further away from them than a mom will. Because the moms, we're like, oh no, baby, oh no, oh, oopsie, you fall, and oh, oh, you're okay. And the guys, we've all seen it, the guys are like, go, fly, you know, if you fall down, suck it up, get up. And, you know, we talk about, we give lip service to, you know, kids need a mom and a dad, but it's true. And we can stop that without realizing it by saying, go get him. You know, he skinned his knee. You need to go comfort him. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but that's more us. So that's, for in terms of calling a boy into life, often it is us stepping back and letting him step up. And often guys that we think aren't stepping up will once we get out of the way. One of you, there you go, at the table. That was you, yes. Okay, yeah, no. Okay, so A, it could be listening. And remember, you're just not listening is you're not listening to my feelings. Okay, so just always remember, stop whatever she's talking about. Just ignore what she's talking about and listen to her feelings about it and call out the feelings. But it, you just don't understand me is usually a signal of something actually a little bit different. And it starts, again, it starts young. And it starts accelerating through about age 8, 9, 10, and it starts hitting a peak at about age 11 or 12. And it's going through a childhood developmental phase that, and forgive me because I'm not a childhood developmental expert, but the experts call it, you know, the transition from one stage to the identity-seeking stage. And the you just don't understand me is usually actually a signal that they're starting to not understand themselves. And they're starting to realize they are a separate person from you with separate opinions, separate desires, and they don't know what those are yet. And it's kind of scary. The developmental people say, in general, elementary school, grade school is the time where you look around and figure out what the world looks like around you. And an example of that is you look at mom, and you look at dad, and you think, what does it mean to be a woman? What does it mean to be a man? Like, that's part of what's going on. And how do you figure, I'm a girl, so, you know, what does it mean to be a woman? And who is mom? And who is dad? And then somewhere around, nobody knows, it's all different for every kid, but somewhere around the age of 11-ish, it's like this switch flips, and it actually starts to happen even younger, but then it just flips very quickly, where suddenly there's this awareness of not who is mom and who is dad, but who am I? And they call it the identity-seeking stage. And once they flip into that new identity-seeking stage, it is so critical to stop saying, oh, I understand you. No, I do understand you, honey, because they're thinking, I don't understand myself. How can you understand me? And instead, tell me more. Why? Help me understand why this bothers you. I'll listen as long as you want. You know, those kinds of questions. You want to talk about this tomorrow? You know, I know you don't want to talk about it anymore right now, but you want to talk about it tomorrow while you know, if you've had time to process. And really important at that point, and this is going to freak everybody out in the room, it's really critical at that point that you let them ask the natural questions that come along, like, I know my parents believe in prayer, but do I believe in prayer? And they're going to start saying things that sound like, you know, I'm just not sure I believe like you do, Mom. I'm not sure that God answers prayer. And if you don't know this, you start freaking out like, what do you mean? You know, we've been to church our whole lives and you've seen God answer prayer and blah, right? And instead, see it for what it is. It's a test balloon. It, even though they're saying, I'm not sure I believe, it's actually him or her saying, I don't know. And it's so critical to say, well, you know, honey, that you know what we believe. We've seen. Remember when such and such happened? We've seen that. But I know you need to answer that for yourself. Whatever it is, whether it's a big thing like faith or little things like, you know, whether they really like this person or that person. So anyway, just that, it's so critical, because if you start, quote unquote, pushing, if they see you as pushing, they're going to feel even more of a need to get distance from that. And they may not talk to you about it. And you want them to talk to you about it. Back in the back. Last one. Hey, believe me, do I look like a meek, subservient woman? I mean, this is one of those things. It took me a long time to come to terms with what I was hearing. And finally, let me answer the last question first, the big one. The reality is, it's really a matter of coming to terms yourself with, and this is part of that, you know, praying God for God to open your eyes to some degree, to any area that you're not quite letting him right now, maybe, okay? If that's even the case, but ask him, are there any areas that I need my eyes opened? And please do that. But recognize, just from a kind of a logical, you know, intellectual standpoint, the reason we have trouble with that is because we're not him. And once I realized that I needed to put myself in his shoes and figure out, why is this so painful for him? Grow up, right? You know, why? You're so oversensitive. No, okay, wait, maybe he's not. Would I want him to tease me about needing to lose 10 pounds? And if I got upset and he said, just grow up. Okay, so, and I started to realize there, it is a matter of recognizing that because of how differently we're created, and how whatever you say theologically, maybe it's, some of it's because of the curse, whatever, I don't know. But because of those differences, different things hurt men and hurt women. And just like you would want him to recognize what those things are for you and what that speaks to you and show you love in the way you needed it, if you want him to do that for you, we should do that for him. So it's kind of almost getting past that kind of, from what for me was kind of, I hate to say it, I kind of had a chip on my shoulder. I got my back up really easily. And I had to get past that. And I had to recognize, you know what, this is just an area I need God to open my eyes. And it was really interesting because God really did open my eyes. I started to see this everywhere. And now I have a son and I'm like, oh my goodness, I see this everywhere. So that's the first thing is your second question, is just keep an eye out for it. Ask God to open your eyes and see and find ways to see if you can put yourself emotionally in his shoes rather than in yours. In answer to your first question about you're trying to talk to your husband and he's doing stuff and you kind of feel, and this, okay, listen, okay, our guys aren't perfect, just like we're not perfect. Okay, maybe he is trying to avoid a conversation. Let's just acknowledge that could actually be happening, right? But it's also quite possible that there is that side-by-side thing going on. And actually, guys have found, because it makes them a little uncomfortable sometimes to have that eye-to-eye contact, especially if it's a we need to talk kind of thing. They have learned that in order to be able to listen without their brain wanting to shoot out the window, they have to have coping mechanisms. And one of them is to be busy about something. This is actually, by the way, for those of you who have boys in school, this is actually one of the reasons why schools are so difficult for boys and boy brains, is because boy brains learn best when the boy is moving. The male brain, the learning center, is stimulated by movement. So that's why little boys get wiggly in the classroom, is their attention is wandering, and they're trying to move to get their attention back. And the teacher says, sit still, and that's the end of them learning. And it's the same thing with our husbands sometimes too. So I could go on these questions all day.